irony at Easter, seeing him who is not there anymore. I had a lot of fun with this passage, so we'll be setting up some things. I'm sure that some of what I'll say will be new information. It was fun making discoveries over the past several days on this. We have 3 points here. Seeing an empty tomb, verses 1 through 5. Seeing the unseen in the empty tomb, verses 6 through 10. And then seeing the risen Christ, 20:11 through 18. I see this as a progression. When Mary came to the tomb, she didn't perceive that anything good had happened. Peter and John came, and they figured it out. But then Mary Magdalene was able to see the risen Christ. So there is a progression. We'll have a lot more to say about Mary Magdalene next time, but I'm not going to take away the thunder for what we'll be doing in chapter 4. The last part of chapter 20 and the first part of 21. But on the first day of the week, Mary of Magdala came to the tomb early while it was still dark, and she saw the stone which had been removed from the tomb. Now, in John's account, nothing is said directly about the other women coming. However, we are going to discover that the other accounts, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, each indicate that there were women that accompanied her. But I'd like for you to notice something. If you look at verse 2, so she ran and went to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved and told them, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they put him." John doesn't name any of the other women, but Mary Magdalene's statement in verse 2 indicates that there was a plurality. We have several things here to iron out. There are a lot of accusations in this passage of contradictions between the gospel accounts. There are none, and I would like to deal with some of the alleged contradictions. I'm not going to deal with any that strictly are limited to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but I will deal with ones that pertain to the text of John. Now, if we compare the accounts, the women here are the named women in the accounts. Matthew says Mary Magdalene and another Mary. Mark says the same but adds Salome. Luke says Mary Magdalene, another Mary, Joanna, and other women. So the fact that Luke says other women means that there had to be at least two, and we're able to discern these. We aren't able to come up with other names. John only mentions Mary Magdalene, and then in verse 2, the mention of we, which indicates at least one other woman, but in Luke's account, we find that there were at least five. What is it that they saw? In each case, we are told, a moved stone. Who they saw is described in Matthew as an angel. Mark looks by appearance, so does Luke, saying a man in white. And then Luke says two men. Well, let's look at this a little more closely, but with one particular issue. This is a place where there's an alleged contradiction. when you read each of the accounts one at a time, you find that some of the accounts say that they came while it was dark, and some accounts say that they did so while it was at dawn. This is an easy reconciliation. Now, Diane and I recently made a trip to California, and I could truthfully say that John and Diane went to San Diego Christmas morning. But I could also say we went to San Diego Christmas evening. And it's not that we flew out to California, came back to Tennessee, and flew back out a second time the same day. Rather, there is flexibility in the Greek term erchomai. It can either be that from the standpoint of coming or going. Going will tend to have an emphasis on where one is departing from, whereas coming will tend to focus upon the arrival. And so we took off from Knoxville in the morning, and we landed in San Diego that evening. Of course, we had an intermediate stop as well. But people often will allege that there's a contradiction between the accounts, and there simply is not. As far as the timing of the travel, it depends upon whether the individual author is emphasizing the leaving in the morning, leaving from home, or the arrival at the tomb. And since it's going to take a while to walk there, you can leave in the dark but arrive at the time of sunrise. That's a simple solution. Now, let's look at this a little differently. This is a scene on the Colorado River in Utah. And here it is before sunrise, as the sun is just fixing to get up over the horizon. And then on the right, it's at sunrise. So John chapter 20, verse 1 says, while it was still dark, that's looking at the departure. But then Matthew 28:1 specifically says at sunrise. Mark 16:2 is translated different ways, but there is flexibility, and it can easily be translated as the sun was rising. Some will understand it after the sun had arisen, but it is a flexible grammatical construction. It would allow either of those translations, but to reconcile it with Matthew, I would take it that it is at sunrise. Now, Luke 24:10 says very early, which could either be pre-dawn or dawn. No contradiction whatsoever in the traveling to the tomb. It's just looking at it sometimes from a little different standpoint. So we have the women named. Then what was seen? We mentioned there the timing of the trip. But now we have who they saw. An angel, man in white, two men. People often think of this as contradictory, that here we have Mark and Luke speaking about men rather than an angel, but they're speaking from the standpoint of appearance, which is not saying that they were not angelic beings, but it's looking, you know, they have a man type of appearance. So it's speaking from the standpoint of visually. I notice that Mary Magdalene will say nothing about seeing anyone there. We'll have a little bit to say about that later. Now, let's back up a little bit. Notice in Mark's account, man in white, and then Luke has two men. People will often say, well, that's a contradiction. Is you have account in Mark saying, or in Matthew, that the one being spoke, and then you have in Luke the two spoke. And later on in John, it's going to mention at another appearance later the same day that the angels, plural, spoke to Mary. So people often say, well, this is contradiction. Well, let's think about this. What does they said mean? Now, obviously, if we're looking at the left-hand side, those children said the Pledge of Allegiance. And they are saying in unison, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. And every single one of them is supposed to be speaking at the same time, saying exactly the same word at exactly the same time. If I say, they said, does that require speaking in unison? Now let's pretend that we are a couple hundred years ago, and George and Martha Washington invited us to their home for dinner. Now when I say George and Martha invited us for dinner, are we expecting that George and Martha are speaking in unison like when children recite the Pledge of Allegiance? No, that isn't what that means at all. If I were to name any husband and wife and say they invited us to dinner, no one is imagining that the husband and the wife are speaking in unison, please come to dinner. It means there's a spokesperson, but the spokesperson is speaking on behalf of both of them, expressing what both of them wish to happen. So if it says that the angels, plural, spoke, that is not a contradiction with saying an angel spoke to the women. Because in all probability, what you have is a spokesperson, shall we say, angel, speaking on behalf of both of the angels. And we use they spoke to stand for the spokesperson that represents the other. But yet you can have an account that will say an angel spoke or a man spoke, and there's no contradiction between them. People often get a little concerned about this. I know most of you, this is self-evident, but these are just some of the alleged contradictions. Okay, so we have at least five women. They saw that the stone was moved. This is perfectly in harmony with there being two angelic beings present, and we've harmonized the time of the trip. They left while it was dark. They arrived at sunrise. Now in verse 2a, Mary Magdalene ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple whom Jesus loved. Now, in John's Gospel, John the Apostle never names himself. And you might think, for those who haven't heard the explanation on this, that, wow, it sounds a little big-headed for the author to call himself the disciple whom Jesus loved. But I would think that this is a moniker. This is something that John came to be known for. And so he's using terminology that people would understand, but he does not name himself. I think that one of the reasons that he didn't name himself is a problem that once in a while I've encountered. Sometimes people will say, well, John said, and when we're looking at the Gospel of John, does it mean John the Apostle said? Or was it John the Apostle quoted John the Baptist? Or was it John Nemela quoting John the Apostle quoting John the Baptist? With all those people named John, sometimes it becomes a little complicated. And so the Apostle chose not to name himself in this book, in 1 John, 2 John, or 3 John, but he did name himself in the book of Revelation. And the term here, or the phrase, that he's the disciple whom Jesus loved, as we considered several months ago, in the last discourse, Jesus said that one who heeded his word would be one that the Lord would especially love. And John seems to be the first of the disciples, very possibly the first or possibly the second of the disciples to believe that Jesus was resurrected from the dead. Anyway, Mary has gone out. She's panicking, so she isn't going to have the smile that this woman has. She's upset at that time. She goes running there in order to go and get the posse out to deal with what the problem is. So she says, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they put him." For those that have just joined us, the fact that she says "we" is giving an indication that there were other women with her. But now she's alone, she's by herself, and has come running in order to get Peter and John. And so she announces the problem. She thinks that grave robbers have been at work. Could it be the Judean leadership, or could it be the Romans, or somebody? She doesn't know who to blame, but somebody, some unspecified people, must have come and taken the body. So, now the question becomes, she is the only, John's Gospel is the only one at this point that doesn't mention that there were any angelic beings, that there was anyone there at the tomb. And so we have a question. Why is it that she didn't, that apparently she didn't mention it? Well, if we were to look at Mark 16:8, it tells us that the women were fearful and they didn't speak to anyone. Now, this doesn't mean that they did not speak to anyone at all. It means that at this particular time, they were being very careful about to whom they spoke. Let's see. There are passages in the text where not speaking to anyone is not used absolutely, and there were, I mean, for example, when Jesus healed the leper, he said, "Don't tell anyone," but then he said, "Go show yourself to the priest." Well, he was going to have to say, "Okay, priest, I used to have leprosy. Now I'm healed. Please examine me." Jesus wasn't saying, "Don't tell it to the priest." When he said, "Don't tell it to anyone," he meant, this is not for the common man on the street. It's on a need-to-know basis. So when we find that there are some instances where they spoke, that's not in contradiction with Mark 16:8. Mark 16:8 may be a more limited statement about anyone that is anyone other than specific people that they were told to speak to. But there might be even a different solution. See, here, Mary Magdalene may have been afraid to mention the angels to John and Peter because what will they say? Will they laugh at her if she said, "By the way, there were two angels there"? And, you know, you have to think there, she might wonder, okay, is this something that I had better say, or maybe they can come and see for themselves? You know, it's the question here becomes, did she want to avoid saying it, even though she knew it? But there's another possibility, and that is that, let's picture this. We have a group of five women going up to the stone. It's right at dawn, and they can see that this stone has been moved. They can see it before they get right up to it. And it could be that, like with Saint Bernard that has the cask there to help one in need, that they say, "Mary, will you please go get Peter and John and let them sort things out?" And it might be that she never even saw the angels and never even heard them. Is it option one or is it option two? I don't know. The text leaves it open. It's possible that Mary didn't say what she knew, but it's also possible she didn't know about the angels. And in some ways that makes things make a little more sense, because she has a half-baked story. If she had talked with the angels, one would expect that she would have figured out the first time, there early in the morning, the angels say that Jesus has risen. And, you know, she ends up in a quandary here. Later on, she sees the two angels and seems oblivious to them and recites to them in verse 12 that someone stole the body. I suspect that she took off to get help before they even got to the tomb, before anyone saw the angels, and before any of them heard the communication from the angels. So, now we have had her come and make the announcement to Peter and John. So Peter and the other disciple left and went to the tomb. Now the two were running together. That is, they were for a while, but we're going to find out that John ran faster. And so he got there ahead of Peter. Presumably John was a younger man. The other disciple outran Peter and came to the tomb first. Bending down, he saw the linen cloths lying, but did not enter. So he is looking in. He has to stoop over a bit because the opening isn't full height. And that's so he's outside. He looks. He's arrived first. And he sees the layout of this. And then suddenly, Peter arrives. Okay, that's in verse 6. But so we've had the empty tomb scene. Mary Magdalene may not know that it's empty. She knows that the stone has been rolled away. She's assuming it's empty. But now we're going to have Peter and John come to understand something that can't be simply seen. Because what they are going to do is put together what has happened based upon what they do see and what they don't see. They are seeing the unseen in the empty tomb. So in 6a and b, Simon Peter came following John, and he entered the tomb. He saw the linen cloths lying, but the face cloth, which had been on his head, was not lying with the linen cloths, but was folded separately in its place. So if you look at the left-hand picture, you see the linen cloths, and then you see a folded up face cloth. We have a larger depiction of face cloth, and in looking at that put in place very neatly, this doesn't look like grave robbers. This looks like care has been taken. It doesn't look like the rush job that would be doing if the Judean leadership had sent someone in to steal the body, or even if the Romans had. So, this causes thinking. What exactly has gone on here? This doesn't look like a grave that has been robbed. So then the other disciple who came to the tomb first entered. He also saw and believed. Now, we have a little grammatical issue. The text is open on this issue, but I'm going to show the two options. Now, I love to diagram, so that's what I do. There are two ways that this passage could be diagrammed. And it's the placement of the word also. Does also only speak about that John also saw? In other words, Peter saw and John also saw. That's what it depicts on the left-hand side, with also modifying the word saw. John also saw, just like Peter had seen. But John only believed. That is, Peter didn't believe, but John did believe. That's the option on the left-hand side. So the light bulb has gone off in this depiction in John's head. But on the left, the right-hand side, we could say there could be two light bulbs. John also saw and believed. Now that would be depicting Peter saw and John also saw. Peter believed and John also believed. The way that the grammar is set up, it's quite open as to whether it is hinting that Peter believed. Now, let's go back to what Peter saw. Peter saw that the face cloth and the linen cloths are separate, and the face cloth is folded up neatly. Can't prove it, but I suspect that both Peter and John at this point believed. But now the question is, what did they believe here in John 20, verses 7b through 8. Is it that they believed in Jesus for everlasting life? No. That already happened in John chapter 1. And if a person wants a further evidence of this, in John chapter 13, verse 10, Jesus said, "Y'all," and he's speaking to 12, including Judas. He says, "Y'all are all clean, but not everyone." And John tells us that he said this because he knew his betrayer. So Judas is identified in that passage as an unbeliever. Well, the 11 are signaled as believers, and then in John 15:3, after Judas has left, he left in John 13:30, then it says, y'all are clean. So Jesus has identified all of his disciples, that is all of the 11, as believers. And we have specific information in John chapter 1 that makes it conclusive that they were already believers in John chapter 1. So the concept of what John and Peter believed in verses 7b through 8 is not in Jesus for everlasting life. They had done that a long time before, but they have believed that Jesus' death has culminated in his resurrection. So, I have more to say about this, but I'm not going to steal my thunder. We'll talk about this later. There is further proof within the book that what it's talking about here is that they believe that Jesus has been resurrected. That's the content that they believed. Okay, we find in verse 9 that they did not yet know the scripture that he must arise from among the dead ones. So the disciples went to their own homes again. Please notice my translation, from among the dead ones. The word dead is a plural word, and it is, I could have translated it, the corpses. People often treat the phrase risen from the dead as if it were saying risen from death. That is, that phrase, when it's worded that way, is speaking about rising out from among those who are dead. Jesus is called the first fruits of the dead, which means more than this, but at the minimum, it refers to he is the first one resurrected, that is, raised from the dead, never to die again. There are other people like Lazarus and others that were raised to physical life who would once again die. But the important thing in this passage is the disciples did not, these two disciples had not yet believed the scripture. They had not believed Old Testament passages saying that it is necessary that Jesus rise. And it's, shall we say, ignorance of Old Testament truth. Let's mention a couple of passages that would demonstrate this truth. In Psalm 16, verse 10, speaking about the Messiah, you will not leave my soul in Sheol, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. Jesus did not stay in the tomb long enough to experience corruption, and he was not abandoned. This passage is speaking clearly of resurrection. Now, we talked a little bit last time about Psalm 22:1, and how the heading of Psalm 22:1, saying, set to on the dear of the dawn, telling the music that would be used for the singing of Psalm 22, I talked about a feature of our earth, that the atmosphere is in layers, that since the earth is curved, the layers are also curved. If you look at the depiction in the upper left, when you're looking at a sunrise, it can look as though it's taking a long time for that sun finally to get over the horizon. It looks like it's ready to come over, ready to come over, ready to come over, but it seems like it's delayed. And part of it is an optical illusion, because with the layers of air, it causes the light to bend somewhat. It's somewhat traveling parallel to the layers of air, just like if it were going through an optic fiber. And so the person is looking and expecting the sun to be up at a certain height, but then it's down lower. Let me give a different illustration. You know how when a bear cub up in the Pacific Northwest is first trying to get salmon out of the river, it sees the salmon in the water and it doesn't realize that where it's looking, that the salmon is actually in a little different place. So it's pawing and it's trying to grab a hold of it. It tries to bite and it gets a mouthful of water. There's an optical illusion. Well, that optical illusion is very helpful in understanding the music that would be played for Psalm 22, the deer of the dawn. The idea is, it's there, it's ready. It's ready to be sunrise, and then suddenly, like a deer leaping, the sun comes over the horizon and sunrise is there. What does this tell us about the music that would be played for Psalm 22? It would be dark and dreary as it starts out. The psalmist, speaking of the Christ, is talking about how the Messiah is taunted by those that say, you know, call on God, he's forsaken you. He's not going to help you if you call on him. And so on and so forth. And then we get into a depiction of the cross. The whole statement there, it gives a visual picture 1,000 years before the cross of crucifixion. But then, suddenly, we have the dawn. And there's an announcement that you've answered me. And then there's going to be the proclamation that is going to be made there to a generation that is coming yet in the future. And it's the messianic banquet that is pictured. Psalm 22 is teaching the resurrection. Now, let me back up because I've taken a little bit of time on this. Remember, John and Peter did not yet know that the Old Testament taught that the Messiah must rise. Psalm 16 teaches that. Psalm 22 teaches that. Now, let's see, I've got things out of order here, but okay, I guess I never put a slide in for introducing Psalm 53. In Psalm 53, it speaks about the Messiah dying, and then it speaks about him dividing the spoils. That's picturing him as victorious, even though he's died, which is it leads to the inference that he has risen from the dead. There are Old Testament passages teaching this. What's the idea when it speaks about dividing spoils? Well, here we have the Potsdam Conference near the end of World War II. And the European war is over at this point, and the Allied powers are figuring out how are they going to divide up Europe. And lo and behold, this is the result of it. They were dividing the spoils. They were figuring out what to do now that Germany is no longer in control of most of Europe. And so essentially the property lines were divided. Who gets what? Dividing the spoils is speaking about Jesus as victor. The Messiah ultimately wins. He has to be resurrected in order for him to reign, in order for him to do all the things that are predicted of the Messiah. You may remember in John chapter 12 that when Jesus spoke about himself being lifted up, that is, being crucified, the people understood that he was speaking about his death, and they said, "Who is this Son of Man? As we've heard from the law that the Messiah must remain forever." They think that Jesus is contradicting his claim to be Messiah, because if he dies, how could he live forever? Well, he can be resurrected and live forever and reign forever. The Old Testament pictured this truth. John and Peter at this point do not understand it. They're clueless on this. In Luke chapter 24, Jesus is going to need to open their minds to understand that all the things that the law, the prophets, and the writings said must happen to the Christ indeed did happen to the Christ. So, at this point, they're not worried. They don't go out and panic in order to figure out, well, what do we do now? His body's been stolen. They went back to their own homes. So, we first had the seeing the empty tomb at dawn by the women. Then John and Peter came to see the unseen in the empty tomb. We're told specifically that John believed, but the way that the grammar is set up, it leaves open the possibility that the word also applies both to Peter and to John, seeing as well as believing. John also saw and believed. They believed that Jesus had been raised from the dead. Now, we're going to have Mary Magdalene given another opportunity. So in verse 11, Mary stood outside facing the tomb weeping. So as she was weeping, she stooped to look into the tomb. Remember, the tomb door was short enough that she would need to stoop, a little different than this depiction in this picture, as well as John needed to stoop. It was a lower opening. She saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head, one at the feet, where Jesus' body had been lying. Now, as I mentioned earlier, when we were going through the apparent contradictions, the alleged contradictions between all of the accounts of the resurrection appearances, it is very possible that Mary Magdalene took off when she was with the group of at least five women, that they could see as it's dawn, oh, the tomb is open. Someone must have robbed the tomb. She might have gone hightailing out to get Peter and John. We're told that she was running to get them. This may be the first time she's seen the angels. That would account for why she didn't mention it earlier, but it would also account for her not quite dealing with exactly what the angels say to her. But she sees them. One at the head, one at the feet, where Jesus' body had been lying. Obviously, those two angels weren't in exactly those spots when John looked in, when Peter looked in earlier, because he saw both the linen cloths as well as the folded up face cloth. But anyway, remember we talked earlier about they said doesn't mean speaking in unison, just like if we were alive in the time of George and Martha Washington, if I were to say, they invited us to dinner, it would mean that the two of them were speaking in unison, like someone saying the Pledge of Allegiance. So we're going to have two angels speaking. It doesn't mean that both angels were speaking at the same time, saying exactly the same words. But as we look at this passage, there is an elephant in the room. And that is, Mary Magdalene seems to be oblivious to the fact that there are angels here. If there are angels here, who could have stolen the body? I mean, aren't angels a little stronger than anyone who might try to steal a body? I mean, wouldn't it make sense to ask a few more questions, like, maybe she needs to push the reset button and say, let's see, everything's different than I think. Could you please clue me in? But that's not what she does. She goes on autopilot. And so she is asked by the two angels, ma'am, I prefer that to woman, why are you weeping? I mean, it is meant to be polite. It doesn't sound polite in English to say woman, but ma'am does. So she told them, because they've taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they put him. She's not thinking clearly here. I mean, these angels would be stronger beings than anyone that would come in and try to rob the grave, so it's like, she should be listening rather than speaking, but she's insisting on speaking here. But I'm going to say something surprising, and that is that what Mary said is actually pretty close to the truth. It's not exactly the truth, but it is pretty close, because there's a word play that's going on here. There's double speak happening here. What Mary meant is false, but her words were almost true. This is a fun passage to look at in the Greek. Now, here's the Greek of this transliterated, and a translation of what she meant to say. They took away the Lord of me. Aaron, ton, kurion, mu. And the sad face is depicting it all. That's her understanding. And, this is bad news here. But just like Caiaphas could speak about how it was expedient for one man to die, so that the nation would not perish, it had a meaning that was totally different than what Caiaphas intended. Mary's words also have a totally different meaning. The word Aaron, coming from Iro, can also be lifted up or raised, and it is a term that is used in the text of resurrection. And so they raised the Lord of me. Now the problem here is the plural, and that, yeah, even though we have the Trinity, we would expect probably wouldn't use a plural here, unless you're speaking in a Semitic tongue. Then, you know, that's, but even there, the pronoun she would use would be, she would use a singular verb form. So strike that thought. So I'd like to do a little word study on the word Iro, which shows up 101 times in the New Testament. 19 times it means to lift, and it's only lifting, not doing anything besides lifting an object or a person. Sometimes it means to lift an actual object, but the phrase is idiomatic, pointing to something else. That happens once. Then it is used four times where it means lift only, not lift and move or lift and remove, but it has a purely figurative sense. Then there are 12 times that it means to lift and move an object or person. 23 times it means to lift and remove an object or a person. 3 times it means to lift and hold, that is, support an object or a person. 38 times it has nothing to do with lifting. To remove an object or a person without lifting, or to remove money, that is, collecting money from someone. So 101 uses. Lifting only of an object or a person. I can have someone picks up a bedroll, or pick up a dead body, or all this is off by one line. Matthew 17:27 is it's two separate texts, and I didn't get them lined up right. Okay, I see what happened. Anyway, bedroll, corpse, eyes, that is, looking up, a fish that's been caught, lifting up one's hand, lifting a lifeboat so that it can be set into the water, mountain, snakes, stone, or stones. Then we have a figurative meaning that shows up in Acts 27:13. I'm obviously going to have to clean up those slides a little bit. But in Acts 27:13, talking about the voyage in which Paul was shipwrecked, it says that they lifted anchor and they sailed close by Crete. Lifting the anchor is allowing the boat to sail, but the only way the boat moves is for the wind to blow it when the anchor is pulled up. That, by the way, is an ancient Roman anchor on the left-hand side. And so, unlike our cars where we take our foot off the brake and the car starts moving slowly and we hit the gas pedal and moves faster, when you're on a sailing boat, lifting the anchor is the beginning of the voyage, but you're dependent upon the wind. So it has a figurative meaning. Lifting anchor can be a term of starting the voyage. And that's the way it's used here. So it has a figurative meaning beyond the literal of lifting the anchor out of the water. We have the purely figurative uses of lifting one's voice, that is, speaking loudly, looking upward, or lifting up one's soul, that is, keeping someone in suspense about something. Then we have lifting up or lifting and moving an object or a person, bearing one's cross, the soldier who would win the seamless garment of Jesus, luggage, things for a trip, picking them up, taking them, a money bag, carrying the paralytic on a stretcher to Jesus, or taking Jesus' yoke. Then we have lifting and removing, not just moving, but taking out of the premises, getting rid of. So baskets, Paul's belt, taking clothes out of one's house, removing a corpse, removing household goods, or picking up the leftover loaves and disposing of them. Lifting and holding, that is, supporting. And we've seen this in John chapter 15 too. Instead of taking away the branches, it's that the 11 are supported by God. And then when Satan is tempting Jesus, he speaks about the angels, you throw yourself down and they'll support you. They'll keep you from crashing on the ground. Now, Jesus didn't yield to the temptation. Then removing an object or a person without lifting. Armor, bad attitude, speech, believers, a certificate of debt, a cloak, a gravestone, household goods, Jesus, that is killing, joy, a key of knowledge, or the millennial kingdom, money, mortal life, that is, if one's mortal life is taken, that one has been killed. Moving a mountain, removing a patch of cloth, removing all the people in the day of the flood, withdrawing money, which actually should be at a different location, a privileged role. The Sanhedrin had privilege that the Romans allowed them to have, and if they disappointed them too badly, they would lose their position. Removing a servant, no longer to serve. This, taking away the sin of the world. Taking the sown word out of someone's heart, or taking away understanding. Then in Luke 19, talking about the master there, that he collected what he did not deposit. So anyway, we have a lot of uses, and you'll notice it can either mean to lift, move, remove, or a combination of them. And so Mary intended it as they took away my Lord. But I think John is seeing, lo and behold, her words are almost true. They raised my Lord. Very interesting. That's what I call the irony of the cross, and that's why I have the title of this, Irony at Easter. Now, Mary turned around and she saw Jesus standing. She's already missed it when she's talking with the angels. She didn't know that he was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Ma'am, why are you weeping? Whom do you seek?" Asking the same question that the angels asked. Whom do you seek? Supposing he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away," interesting, that's the word, iro. She said that others took him away, and now she says, if you've carried him away, if you're the one, then tell me. Okay, carried away actually is a different word, and I will take him away. That's iro, the second usage. Jesus said to her, "Mary." Upon turning around, she said to him, "Rabboni," which means teacher, or more literally, my teacher. When he spoke to her, that's when she had recognition. She wasn't hearing what the angels were saying. She hasn't heard what Jesus has said up to this point. Now, it makes sense. Now, she figures out. I had not thought. I've assumed that she now at this point is seeing his wounds. And so I took this picture because seeing the wounds in the feet, but whether she sees the wounds in the hands or sees it in the feet, she would obviously want to hug him and hold on to him and don't leave me, because all the way through the last discourse, and this would have been reported to her by the disciples, that Jesus kept saying, he's going to leave. He's going to go to the Father. And I think Jesus is saying, stop holding on to me. I haven't yet ascended to my Father. That will happen in due time. But now we have to look here a little closer at this. This passage actually gives some big hints. This verse right here, I think, is very, very important for understanding what the disciples understood. Now, first of all, to say here, Jesus isn't saying, don't touch me. And that's the way it's often been interpreted. That's not what he's saying. He's saying, don't hang on to me. I'm not leaving immediately. He's not saying I'm unclean or anything like that. You can't touch me because I'm unclean and all that. I mean, there's a lot of nonsense that's been said about this. None of that's going on here. But this passage is going to give us a clue. For these past 3 days, where had the disciples believed Jesus was? Now, they haven't all disappeared to the four corners of the earth. They haven't all said, okay, we've been with him for over 3 years, and obviously everything he said is false. He's not the Messiah. He died, and we're out of here. They didn't do that. We are told negatively a number of times that they did not believe that Jesus would rise from the dead until, in fact, he had risen from the dead. They didn't even believe it after he died. That interval of the 3 days between his crucifixion and the point when they knew that he had risen, we are told specifically they didn't believe that he rose. Remember, Peter and John have come to that conclusion there as they are at the tomb and they see the linen cloths and they see the neatly folded head covering. The other disciples hadn't yet believed this. Thomas won't believe it for another week. And when we look at the other gospel accounts, we find that there was much disbelief of Jesus having been resurrected among the 11. So, okay, to make a negative statement, the disciples didn't believe that he had been resurrected. What did they believe? They hadn't rejected his message. They hadn't rejected him. They hadn't said, okay, all this is false. This was a fun experiment, but it's all proven false. They haven't done that. There's a difference between a statement they didn't believe his resurrection and being able to state what they did believe. My classic illustration is, if I say, it wasn't a red car, you're thinking, maybe it's a green car, maybe it's a blue car, maybe it's a white car. And I say, maybe it's a green tractor. For me to say it's not a red car just narrowly says it's not this one thing, but it could be a whole multitude of other things. A statement the disciples did not believe that he would be resurrected. Well, they didn't believe he was going to die, so they didn't believe that he needed to be resurrected. Then when he did die, what did they believe? I think we've got a little clue here, as I said earlier. Jesus said, "Stop holding on to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father." Now, I'm not in a position to say, "Thus saith the Lord," for what I'm going to say here, but I think it's a reasonable possibility. It seems to me very likely that the disciples had telescoped the idea of resurrection and ascension. What do I mean? Jesus said, "I'm going to leave. I'm going to go to the Father. And I'm not going to see you for a while." How would the disciples put this together? They are obviously quite despondent about Jesus saying he was going. Remember, Peter said, "Well, I'm even willing to lay down my mortal life for you," John chapter 13. "Why can't I go with you now?" What they heard is, "I'm going away, I'm going to the Father." And I would assume that they telescoped the idea of resurrection and ascension and said, "Oh, where's Jesus? He's with the Father." So in other words, they'd say, "Okay, everything he said is true. I guess we better stick around here, and somehow we're going to get more instructions." They haven't gone flaking off into every direction of the wind. They're still hanging around, waiting for instructions. But I don't think they were expecting to see Jesus physically on planet Earth. Think about Thomas. When the 10 were saying, "We've seen him," he said, "I'm going to need to put my finger into the nail holes. I'm going to need to put my hand into the spear wound." What he was saying is, "I don't expect to see Jesus physically until he comes back from heaven." He'd say, "He went to be with the Father." Notice what Jesus is saying here. "You don't have to hold on to me because I haven't yet ascended." Jesus hadn't announced that he was planning to be on planet Earth for 40 days before he ascended. Oh, my suspicion is they thought, "Well, yeah, he's ascended." But they weren't expecting a bodily resurrection with Jesus being on planet Earth for 40 days before he ascended. They thought he had already ascended. Now, as I say, I cannot say, "Thus saith the Lord." That's my construction of how to make sense of the things that we're told that they didn't believe. They didn't believe that he was resurrected until they knew that he had been resurrected. They didn't say, "Okay, everything's false. Jesus didn't tell the truth." They figured Jesus told the truth. So that means Jesus must be in a good place. And what was the good place he was talking about going to? Being with the Father. They've assumed that has already happened. They're not expecting to see him on planet Earth. That's my take. Okay. So, there's something that I said earlier that I thought was important. I gave an evidence that the content of belief that that Peter and John had in verses 7 and 8 was that Jesus has been resurrected. Well, that picture starts to come really clear if indeed I'm correct that they thought, he went straight to be with the Father. Now they're looking and they're saying, this is an empty tomb. He no longer needs the linen garment. He no longer needs the headcloth. Is he walking around on planet Earth? These two very possibly have more figured out than we might think. I'm not prepared to say how much they understood, but they did believe that he had been resurrected, and it's not impossible that those two were expecting to see him. So now Jesus gives instruction to Mary Magdalene. But go to my brethren and tell them, I will ascend. Future. He hasn't told her how long it's going to be. It'll be 40 days. I will ascend to my Father and to your Father, my God and your God. Interestingly, the word your is plural. Notice I have the dot after the word your both times. He's speaking to one person. He's speaking to Mary Magdalene. But he is telling her to carry a message to the 11 in which he is communicating to them, I am going to my Father and y'all's Father. So this is the message that is to be relayed. Jesus is making it very clear some of the issues about what happens when a person becomes a believer in Jesus Christ. And interestingly, he is able to say this truth before the church age begins. Think back to John chapter 1, verse 12. But as many as received him, to them he gave the authority to become children of God, that is, to those who believe in his name. Children of God is the status of believers. He's able to speak to Mary and to the 11 and say that his Father is their Father. This is another statement that the 11 are already believers. Mary of Magdala went telling the disciples that she had seen the Lord and he had told her these things. So she carried out her commission. I will have much more to say about that next week. But as we look at this passage, an empty tomb was seen. I suggested the possibility that Mary Magdalene. Mary Magdalene, as she was in a party of at least five women, might have taken off running to go find Peter and John before actually seeing inside the tomb and seeing the two angels. That may be why she has a very, very cursory report of saying they've taken the Lord. And we don't know where they put him. So she only saw an empty tomb, perhaps only from a distance. the other women seemed to be the ones that had the interview with the angels. But then we have Peter and John coming to see the unseen in the empty tomb, starting to put together the pieces that Jesus has been resurrected, just as he promised, and just as the Old Testament taught. And now in this passage, Jesus showed himself to Mary, here in verses 11 through 18. She spoke something far closer to the truth than she could have imagined. Her words, "They have taken away my Lord," those same words, because of the range of meaning for the verb iro, can mean, "They have raised my Lord." That's fairly close to the truth. God has indeed raised Jesus Christ. That wasn't what she intended, just like Caiaphas did not intend the message that his words also communicated. But it speaks something very close to the truth. We have irony at Easter. And so with that, let's open it up for questions.
Hey, John, I'm ready to ask one.
Okay.
Specifically about that main point you were, or that point you were making about the irony. When you talk about hermeneutics and your teaching of passage, do you call that a kind of a applicational thought? Do you think it's a primary part of the interpretation of the passage that she was actually saying, at least in the words of John or through John, he's been risen? One interpretation, many applications. So what do you do with that?
Well, John's gospel is famous for having double entendres. And John leaves readers to puzzle over many of them. But it clearly is not what she meant to say. But we would have to say that the text tells us specifically that Caiaphas, being high priest, prophesied, but he certainly was not saying that Jesus would deal with the sin problem for the whole world. That wasn't what he intended to say. And yet, he chose words that convey a truth that he would not have affirmed.
So it is true that John actually inscripturated the fact that he didn't know what he was saying, but it was really a truth.
I understand that we have that direct affirmation, but we have a lot of double entendres in John's gospel.
Okay. I love them, John. I think they're fun.
Actually, there's an article that Gary Derrickson wrote in, I believe it was in Grace and Focus, but it might be in the journal. It's called "I Mean Both."
Oh.
And I wouldn't necessarily endorse every point where he handled it, but I would say that it's an interesting... Let's put it this, at the least, it's interesting that Mary's choice of words is a bit ambiguous and comes fairly close to the truth.
Yeah. That's fine, John. I appreciate you addressing it.
John, I have a couple questions. The first one, when I was thinking with Enoch and Elisha both going up, would that be reasonable that the apostles thought that Jesus just was raised straight up without dying?
Sure. Yeah, that would be, those would be some antecedent examples.
I mean, for them to say, well, it's happened before.
Sure.
And Jesus is a godly man, this makes sense. So he had to show him.
Yeah.
The other question I had was when Mary came and said, we've seen the empty tomb, could that be the same thing that Nicodemus is doing in chapter 3 when he comes in and he's representing those Pharisees? So he is the only one there, but he is saying he is representing that group of people?
What I would say there is that her report at this point isn't anything like what the angels instructed the women to communicate, as is indicated in the synoptics. So it doesn't seem to me that
he's a good representative at that time.
Right. So
okay.
That's a reason that I lean towards saying she might not have ever seen the angels. Because if they are coming up to the tomb at dawn, and off from a distance they can see that it's open, well, that immediately is going to mean that the leadership of the disciples, some of the top three, Peter, James, and John, are really going to need to become involved. So, yeah, it's not hard to imagine them coming up on it and saying, okay, Mary, I think you can run the fastest. Why don't you go and get help? And so
I guess the fact that she had to go and meet with them twice in that one day explains that she didn't understand and they didn't understand, at least until they saw the tomb. Well, they didn't understand then because she went and told them again.
Yeah.
Hey John, this is Joseph here.
Yeah.
Was the other woman were with Mary when Jesus spoke to her, or they were three left already?
It seems that she was by herself. So my suspicion is that she had gotten off by herself, which may have even been before they had the interview with the angels. What's happened is she has gone and gotten Peter and John, and she followed them out to the tomb, and they went back home, and she remained there. So, it's dealing with things that are not specified, but it seems easiest for my construct to imagine that the last contact that she had was very likely before they entered the tomb, before the others entered the tomb.
Okay, would you say then there also the other application of that, I don't know if, you know, the disciples, it seems to me they didn't care and they left, seeing the tomb empty, they left. But she, being persistent, she got something beyond the others. She'll be the first to see the Lord out of
yeah.
all the disciples and others. Would you say that's a good conclusion of that?
Yeah, it seems like a reasonable inference.
Thank you.
Hey, John, I have a question on our schedule.
Sure.
Do you want to go over when we meet and when we don't meet in the next couple weeks?
Well, I talked with Julie, and she said that she's fine with the whole month. It's in March that we're going to have issues because Diane will have her surgery on March 5th. So I know I won't be doing it for 3 weeks. I haven't yet figured out with Steve exactly what his schedule is. So that's going to determine what weeks we would have and what weeks it would be taking off.
But you're good for February.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
Bob.
John, when you're ready, I'd like to ask a question about this week's Bible reading.
Sure.
Yeah, it's Exodus 24, 10 and 11. Which, you know, I could give an answer to it, but I want to know what you think. do you want me to read it?
Sure.
And they, referring to the elders of Israel and also Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and they saw the God of Israel, and there was under his feet, as it were, a big work of sapphire stones, and it was like the very heavens in its clarity, but on the nobles of the children of Israel, he did not lay his hand. So they saw God, and they ate and drank. Tell me what you think of that.
I think it was a theophany.
Any significance to the not laying on of hands?
Well, Moses is has a position that no one else is able to approach, and there later on are going to be times when even Miriam and Aaron are trying to move in on it, and you know, God tells them, no, it's Moses that I've selected. And so I think it's very possible. We don't have a lot of detail there, but I would suspect that God was not willing to lay his hands on a plural group when Moses was needing to be looked up to as the one with whom God personally communicated.
Okay. Yeah, that's very reasonable. I not only appreciate your response, but I appreciate you having laid out a reading plan that's balanced in terms of quantity.
Yeah. Yeah, when it's chapters, they can be very different in length.
Yeah. Yeah, so I've even had to play catch up. I get 2 days behind, and it's okay, crash course.
Yep.
Okay, but thanks for doing it.
Sure. Yeah, it's took a little while to lay it out in Excel, and that I wanted it to be even chapters rather than having to keep track of, let's see, we're supposed to be on verse 39 of such and such chapter. I wanted to have chapter breaks, but try to make it an even level of reading.
Easier to read the chart and everything else, and I appreciate it. It's a helpful tool for me. I haven't done it in a few years, so this is refreshing.
Hey, John, I have one last question.
Okay.
I was thinking, could I know it's not quite a double entendre, but in John 3, we have Nicodemus thinking on a horizontal plane, born again. Jesus meant it on a vertical plane. The woman is thinking the water is a horizontal plane. Jesus is talking vertical. And Mary's thinking horizontal. Somebody took away from this earth, and yet it's vertical. God took away or raised up.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of credence because there's at least three of them in the Gospel of John I can think of right here. That's a really good insight.
Yeah, I had never really thought about the use of the word Iro in this passage. We think of it quite a bit in John 15, too, but it just struck me that as I was reading my Greek text, it's like, I know she doesn't mean this, but these words would allow this meaning.
Absolutely. Well, thanks. That was very enlightening tonight.
Jagan, I have one more question, but
okay.
It's too long. We can do it next week. In John chapter 1, what's the significance of the word light there from chapter 1 that appeared about six times and the collaboration with the word life? That makes sense?
Yeah. When he speaks about Jesus as creator, the focus, I believe, is upon him as the creator of life. That seems to be the focal point of creation that that's John's focal point there for creation. And it's requiring enlightenment for people in a darkened world to understand God's provision of life. So I think that those two themes, they come together at a number of points within John's Gospel, not just in John chapter 1. And so, it's an interesting thing as you look at verse 9. I do not like the New King James or the King James translation of John 1:9. New American Standard, for example, does a much better job on it, because there's the word coming is somewhat ambiguous in its form. It's a participle, and as a result of it being a participle, it could be by form a masculine accusative singular, a neuter accusative singular, or a neuter nominative singular. And what that does is it changes in potential what word it modifies. So if I go to John chapter 1 in my New King James, that was the true light which gives light to every man coming into the world. So they understand the word coming as modifying the word man, that is every man. Okay, grammatically that's a possible translation. Interestingly, in John's Gospel, when you look at who came into the world, the only one said to come into the world is Jesus. The closest that we get to that about talking about ordinary humans is in John 12, when it talks about a woman giving birth, and it says that she rejoices because a man has been born into the world. Now, in other words, when someone talks about their children being born, they don't say, well, my child came into the world, or my child came to the United States on their birthday. They were born into it because they were part of their father and their mother, and you know, they were already on planet Earth. They didn't come to Earth. They were already there in the womb. They were in on planet Earth. Jesus is the only one spoken of as coming to Earth. So I would translate it, that was the true light which coming into the world gives light to every man. What it's saying is that Jesus, upon his incarnation, is the one who enlightens the world. How does he enlighten the world? With the truth of the message of life. He's made that available for everyone. How many times in the Gospel of John does it say that Jesus came from above and he says, I'm from above, you're from below? How many times does he speak about he's come from the Father? How many times does he speak about having come to the earth? He speaks about going back to the Father. He speaks about going back to where he came from. All of these things are saying within John's Gospel, there's a tremendous emphasis on him as the one who came into the world. But notice what it says. He's light who enlightens man by coming into the world. The fact that he's here, remember how he said, the fact that I have done signs that no one else does. I've done works that no one else does. And he says that that makes man responsible to interact with him, that is to believe in him. That is light. Light. Let's see. Remember I had some pictures of light bulbs here in this slideshow. I don't think that light really should be understood as a light bulb. And let me explain what I mean. When it says that Jesus is light, we can think of a light bulb that is turned off. I could show up here. Yeah, that's a light bulb that's turned off. And I don't think that Jesus would describe that as light. It's dark. It might be capable of producing light, but that thing up there on the top of the ceiling is dark. What's the point? Light shines. Jesus is communicating truth because of what he said, what's been written about him, the signs that he did. All of that is showing forth light into a darkened world, saying that what they know and what they think is false and does not give light, life. So I think there's a dynamic connection between life and light. And I see that connection going through the book, not just in John chapter 1, but the enlightenment is concerning the message of life.